Wall Street's new love affair with publicly traded weed stocks, calling to mind the dot-com boom, the social media craze, and the more recent Bitcoin bonanza. Canada is set to become the first major economy to make it legal next month. And with estimates the global industry could be surging to $200 billion in 15 years, investors have started to play.
Walmart's going after young urbanites with a top-to-bottom redesign of Jet.com. Walmart's latest strike in its fight with Amazon for online shopping dominance. Jet, which Walmart bought for over $3 billion, announced it will offer speedier delivery and more merchandise. As for speedier delivery, that will be available in New York City this fall, as Jet looks to target a market Walmart has yet to nail: young and affluent city dwellers.
The power of the Nike brand is flexing its muscles. Sales of Nike gear have soared 61% in the 10-day period after the company's controversial decision to feature former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick as a pitch man. The response so strong, according to research conducted by Thomson Reuters, that Nike sold out of more items and was able to do so with fewer discounts compared to the 10-day period before that.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's September 24th, 5:10 in the morning. Thanks for being here with us. Another edition of The Opening Bell and another business day getting underway. We appreciate you joining us this morning for our look at the morning business roundup. Lots of intel from overnight markets we'll get to momentarily on the program today. The 90th anniversary of Motorola Solutions. Motorola Chief Technology Officer Paul Steinberg will be here this morning. We'll have a good conversation with Paul. He is in the PPG Paints Green Room for our CEO Spotlight this morning. We'll get to him momentarily. A little bit later on in the program, we're going to have a conversation about data visualization, how that might help you in your daily life, how you might use that to find information, maybe even help your small business. That'll be in our second segment this morning at 5:40. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, looking at the numbers from around the world. Dow futures are pointing toward a negative open later on Wall Street, off about 41 points. NASDAQ futures are down about a third, and S&P futures are down about a quarter. Around the globe, in London, markets are generally higher this morning, actually lower. The numbers just refreshing themselves now, off 23 points. The DAX off about 49 points, down about a half a percent, and the CAC in France is off about a quarter. In Asia this morning, markets are generally mixed, with the Nikkei up almost a full percent, 195 points. The Hang Seng off more than a percent and a half. The Shanghai is up nearly 2.5%. Oil is trading this morning at $72.06 a barrel. A couple of stories before we begin this morning. Britain's main opposition party has taken a step toward backing a new referendum on Brexit, but has stopped short of saying that the vote should include an option not to leave the European Union at all. Delegates at the party's annual conference in Liverpool will consider a motion tomorrow, saying all options should remain on the table. Also this morning, the Federal Aviation Administration would be required to set new minimum requirements for seats on airplanes under legislation to be considered in the House this week, possibly giving passengers a break from shrinking leg room and cramped quarters on airlines. The regulation of seat width and leg room is part of a five-year extension of federal aviation programs announced early Saturday by Republican and Democratic leaders of the House and Senate committees that oversee the nation's air travels. Farmers across the United States will soon begin receiving government checks as part of a billion-dollar bailout of the tariffs imposed by President Trump with his trade dispute with China. Corn farmers will get the smallest slice of the aid pie. Corn groups estimates a loss of about 44 cents per bushel, but they're poised to receive just a single penny per bushel. Farmers were already feeling the impact of Trump's trade tiffs with China and other countries. China has hit back, responding with its own set of tariffs on U.S. agricultural products and other goods. This is the 90th year anniversary of Motorola. Motorola Solutions Chief Technology Officer Paul Steinberg is with us today in our CEO spotlight. We'll call it the CTO spotlight this morning. Paul, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
I'm very excited to have you in, and happy anniversary to Motorola Solutions as well.
Thank you very much.
90 years.
That's right. 90 years on September 25th.
I can't even begin to imagine all of the history that's involved there, but we can get into some of that here today. When you turn 90, what do you do? What kind of party do you have for a company that's 90 years old?
Yeah, Motorola is about 16,000 employees scattered across the globe. We operate in over 60 countries and actually have customers in over 100 countries. So it's a big party if you want to think of it that mm-hmm. way. But we certainly recognize the heritage of Motorola, and we know that that's what got us here, and always keep an eye on looking forward as well.
You're the chief technology officer, the CTO.
Right.
Tell our audience what that means and what you do.
Yeah, I tell people I have one of the coolest jobs in the world, with all due respect. So, Motorola's purpose in life is helping people be their best in the moments that matter. So some of our customers are fire and police and emergency medical services, personnel. And we provide the communication for, how they get how they help get their jobs done. And so what I'm on the lookout for is technologies that actually help first responders and, heavy industries actually enable their users to be more efficient, effective, and safe at what they do. So cool thing is I get to look at the new technologies, figure out how we can maybe factor that into that higher mission of helping people be their best in the moments that matter, experiment with it, and reduce it to practice and try to get it into their hands.
I want to get into some of that during our interview today, but I want to tell reassure people just how cool you are. Paul brought in some props today. What would you call it? This is an army guy would have this in his hands, but what would you call this?
That's right. That's the Motorola Handy Talkie. Was built in 1942, and it's the first handheld mobile communication device on the planet.
It's pretty cool because it's one of the big green ones. You probably have seen a soldier holding one of these in archive footage, and then next to it, one that's probably about a third of the size of that, small
right.
little green. Who would handle a radio like this?
So the radio you've got there is intended for fire, firefighters, but it would be comparable to what police officers, firefighters, paramedics, and even heavy industry. So, think of your large petrochems, your large manufacturing facilities. They use those kinds of things for group-based communication.
Mm-hmm. You have access to the museum, which is, I'm guessing, how you brought this big one in today.
That's right.
There's a museum. I love that you keep that around. I bet you guys celebrate that, don't you?
Yeah, we actually do. With a company with 90 years of heritage, I think you don't focus on the past, but you have to know that the past is what brought you here. And there's certain things that we're very proud of. So just some of Motorola was there kind of moments. A lot of people don't realize that during the Apollo moon program, Motorola provided all the communication basically between here and the moon. So the words, the Eagle has landed, one small step from Neil Armstrong, came over Motorola equipment. We provided the communication during Apollo 13 as well.
How's the company changed in 90 years?
Oh, gosh. It has changed an enormous amount. The company basically split into two in 2011 and became Motorola Mobility, which was the consumer place. So that's where the cell phones mm-hmm. and all that went. And then in the other half, which I represent, is Motorola Solutions. So it's constantly evolved. But I think if you look in the core of Motorola Solutions, my side of the world, we've really... It's sort of the essence of what Motorola has been for its entire 90 years of existence. It's always been about helping people. It's always been about pioneering communications and allowing people to communicate to get important things done. And that's still what we have our eye on today. So it's kind of interesting how the world kind of sometimes comes full circle. Maybe the constant in all that is people need to talk to each other in times of need. And, that's something that's always been true.
As the chief technology officer, are you in charge of finding the next big thing, finding the next great idea?
Yeah, my CEO, Greg Brown, who's been CEO for 11 years now, he's a fantastic leader. A couple things he tells me, Paul, you need to make sure we don't get scooped so that somebody else doesn't invent the better mousetrap before we do. And then always keep advantaging our business, find something that helps us help our users. And so, yeah, definitely that's an expectation of mine.
How do you do that in a world that seems, to be changing technologically moment by moment? How do you stay on that game?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question, Steve. And that if I were to say, if anything keeps me awake at night, that's certainly it. Rate of change in the world, there's that saying that we're experiencing the lowest rate of change that we'll ever experience in the rest of our lives. And that will be true tomorrow and ongoing. So So the world changes more rapidly, and then how do you stay in front of that? So a few things. We spend a lot of time with our users, understanding, you know, how they work, what they're doing, and more importantly, trying to understand, you know, how we can make them better with technology. So I have a team of customer researchers, ethnographers and human factors engineers, and their job is to live a day in the life with customers. We like to say a user may not be able to tell you what he or she wants or needs, but if you watch them the right way, or if you watch them the right way, they'll show you. And so that base of knowledge is the first step. Understand, you know, the users and their tasks. And then the next thing is look and scour the globe for technologies that might actually help facilitate that. So we invent them organically within. Mm-hmm. But a big part of the equation is Motorola Solutions Ventures, where we actually will look at the startup communities. Primarily, we focus in Silicon Valley, United States, and Israel, looking for technologies that could help us. And we'll invest in those companies and bring them in and apply them to outcomes.
You mentioned Israel there. I've seen and read recently a lot of cool stories about technology and Israel. What is it about Israel that is spurring or causing some of this technological advancement? Are they better at doing that than us, or what's happening with that?
It's a great question. I wouldn't say better, but there's definitely a cultural angle there. If you there's a book written several years ago called Startup Nation, mm-hmm. Which kind of explores exactly your question, Steve, which is, you know, why is Israel one of the most productive, you know, most startup-ridden companies and most successful startup-ridden companies countries in the world per capita? And there are a lot of reasons for that, but it's definitely an innovative place. So we look there a lot. There's a user community there that we can work with, you know, our customers that are early adopters of technology. So experimenting with the technology early as you perfect it is important. And then, of course, like I said, in the U.S. and Silicon Valley is the other place.
Talk about finding these startups, bringing them in some way. Does that mean that you acquire, that Motorola Solutions acquires some of these companies, or do you take a stake in them, or how does that work?
Yeah, great question. So acquisition could be an outcome if mm-hmm. it turns out that becomes a critical ingredient. But if they become part of our portfolio, we definitely do take an investment in them to give us access to them, a little closer relationship, usually a minority investment. And more often than not, we're looking for an ingredient to apply to a broader thesis. And typically when it works best is they may be aimed at an entirely different market than us. And what we may then would want to do is bring them in and apply them to an outcome that our research has informed us might be, you know, informative to our users. Mm-hmm. We'll use them to accelerate a component of the broader idea. Example, would that help?
That would be, yeah.
So a few years ago, one of the things we knew that our users primarily communicate with verbal, spoken, you know, communications. And so how do we convey all this intelligence to them that we're amassing in a way that's eyes up and hands free, and that it leverages what they have. So the natural kind of conversation switches to natural language processing. And at the time, there was no Amazon Echo, you know, none of this had been commoditized and available. So we invested in a startup company that gave us access to a natural language processing engine. So we could actually build essentially what you could think of as Siri or a bot that mm-hmm. allows first responders to communicate with technology to get answers to questions or to command actions.
Very cool. So it's sort of like a firefighter saying, Siri, help me find the plans to this building, or help me, what's around the next corner, or what's in these storage tanks, that kind of question?
Exactly right. Or a police officer wanting to run a wanted warrant on a traffic stop. Mm-hmm. And again, staying focused, eyes up, hands free, but request the technology to do a lookup on a license plate and give them an answer back.
The small radio that you brought, this one that firefighters carry, you mentioned earlier that you learn a lot from watching how a firefighter behaves. And I thought that's the very interesting story about how this radio is developed with the, I guess this is the volume knob, mm-hmm. Tilted a little off to the right.
That's right.
And then there's a red button over here. And give me an idea of why, how this is built for a firefighter.
Yeah, we build it. It's also a great question. And it comes back in this case to a lot of the human factors. So you recognize that firefighters typically have things in their hands or wearing, you know, heavy gloves. The device may be worn on their belt, you know, behind or on their back. So, you know, looking at it, taking it off and accessing it, you know, may not be an easy thing to do. So the knobs are big. They're very distinct. They're easily accessed. They're an angle so you can get gloved hands on them. Even the clicks in the detents so that you can actually count and know clicks and know where the thing is positioned. The emergency button is positioned at the base of the antenna. So if you need to request assistance in an emergency way, you don't have to find the emergency button. You just have to find the antenna. Just slide your hand down the antenna, and that cue is always there. So it's those design cues that we've accumulated over the years again, just trying to drive the device to be as form efficient and safe as possible for them to use.
Here we are within a couple of weeks of the anniversary of 9/11, and after that attack, after that horrible tragedy, there were lots of questions raised about why firefighters couldn't talk to police, why police couldn't talk to firefighters, vice versa. Interoperability,
That's
I
right.
think, is how what that's described. This is a big area where Motorola Solutions involved. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so I think in the earlier days, the different disciplines in public safety were sometimes sliced into different bands of spectrum. So a lot of it was just the way that the radio frequencies were laid out, what they could access, and how they could build their communication. An enormous amount of progress has been made since that terrible event, where now much more harmonization is occurring. You have a lot more different disciplines communicating with common technologies, and so we've pushed really, really hard in that direction. So in Illinois here, for example, there's a network called the StarCom 21 network that it's a statewide network that pretty much anybody, any public safety agency in the state can actually attach to. We actually operate that network, you know, much like a carrier would, and then users can attach to it and communicate with anybody else on the network.
So if it's a fire department or an ambulance company or something like that, you can just turn the button and talk to them.
That's right. Yeah. So you can actually split your time. You can have the local channels and you can have the common channel, and that bridges you to different agencies, whether it's different disciplines like EMS, fire, police, or whether it's state police, county, and city.
You mentioned the eyes-free, hands-free situation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that where all of this is going, that eventually there will be some sort of radio or some sort of device that will not require you to press a button, will not require you to do any of this? It'll just sort of be intuitive?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the eyes-up, hands-free paradigm, that's sort of one of our you know, key design principles that we guide toward. It's pretty obvious in retrospect. You know, you're basically looking up at users, you know, trying to figure out how do they get their job done and how do they stay focused on the surroundings. Obviously, that means eyes up, hands available to do the work. So how do you achieve that goal? And so obviously, voice is one of the most natural ways people have to communicate. But you'll start to see for sure wake word activated communication. You don't even have to press a button. You can actually recognize a speaker wake word. Speaker identification, that becomes important to identify, is this user who I think they are, and so I can know what they have legitimate entitlement and access to. So you'll definitely see those capabilities in the coming years.
Financially, how is Motorola Solutions doing? I would imagine there's a lot of business here. I know you recently did a contract to redo the Army's communications. So there's money here, right? I mean, you're a successful company.
Yeah. So last year we did about $6.4 billion in revenue, so growing, and which is good. And definitely, you know, there's definitely a demand for mission business critical communication and intelligence projects and products. And so, you know, what we're proud to be able to provide that, and we're, you know, we're proud that it's in demand.
I think anybody who has grown up with communications, I remember having a really cool walkie-talkie set. But I'm sure radios like this, people sometimes ask the questions too. What happens in the worst case scenario? Do you deal sometimes with that? Like,
yeah.
How do you communicate person to person, base to base, if all hell breaks loose?
Yeah, Steve, that's a fantastic question. And that's, a lot of people don't fully understand how this thing works. And it is designed for the worst possible scenario. So when we deploy a network, whether it's a statewide or a citywide network, it's designed with local situations in mind. So for example, hurricane, wind loading on towers, you know, those sorts of things. And what invariably happens is when the bad thing happens, the really bad thing happens, our technology is always the last one standing. So it's designed to be that way. It's designed to have all of that resilience built in. And internally, it's got resilience within it. So if you think about comparing it with a cell phone and the technology you and I use in our daily life, it's designed to actually operate that way. So it talks to a network that's comprised of base stations. But if the base stations are disconnected from each other, I have coverage within that range and I can talk to anybody within that range. If the base station itself is destroyed or just was never there to begin with, if I'm in the middle of nowhere fighting a brush fire, or, you know, just the really bad thing happened and everything was flattened, I still have direct communication between devices, typically in the U.S. at a range of about 5 miles. So if all I've got is what I brought with me, I can talk to my colleagues at a range of about 5 miles in a group setting.
Obviously, the idea here is to put out the best possible product, but you have to be thinking, and your team has to be thinking all along, how do we save lives?
That's right.
That's probably the guiding mission, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, I think earlier you'd asked me about my job and it being cool. And, you know, I think that's one of the very cool things about the job is, I would never say we save lives. I think our users are the ones that save lives. They're the heroes every day.
Yeah.
and, you know, go out and, you know, put themselves at risk to keep you and I safe and just call it their job. So, you know, we thank them. If we can do something with technology to make them slightly safer, slightly better at what they do, that's what we strive to do.
Does the government pretty much stay out of your way on this? How is the regulatory view? I think you sit on the FCC, one of the FCC advisory committees, don't you?
Yeah, that's right. So early on, after the 9/11 commission, and then we got into the work and the legislation that created FirstNet, back to the interoperability point, I sat on an FCC panel then to actually, you know, help design the interoperable standards for, in this case, it was a broadband-based communication path. And now the FCC has something called the Technological Advisory Committee, so I sit on that as well. So, you know, government is there for a reason. They regulate for a reason, and we certainly work within the confines and bounds of those regulations. The tricky part is when you get to some technologies that haven't been contemplated by the regulations, then you have to figure out how do you design the rules around it so that things like interoperability are possible.
I want you to, and your company, to be able to celebrate the 90 years that you've survived and flourished. But do you have people there either behind the scenes or in front of the scenes talking about the next 90 years and what might that look like for Motorola Solutions?
Yeah, it's interesting. You said the next 90 is something that's come up a lot. And, you know, I don't bet you, I do well to think about the next 9 months.
Right.
But, you know, at the rate of technology change today, it's really hard to imagine what 90 years, if you just think about where Motorola started, and the first product Motorola built, and that's where the name came from, was essentially the car radio. And so Moto for Moto Vehicle, Rola short for Victrola, put those together and you get essentially car music. And so if you think about that 90 years ago, that was the cutting edge technology. Cars didn't have radios in them, so there was an OEM business around that. And now you roll the clock 90 years forward, look at where we are relative to that today. Now you say, okay, let's project another 90 years and see, well, if what's that going to be at the increased rate of change? I would say we definitely are always looking forward. We use a lot of the tools we talked about to definitely do that. You know, I think it's hard to predict 90. It's I'm working with, you know, five or so.
Yeah. But again, back to your cool job. I mean, you get to see patents. You get to see, every once in a while, you'll see like Google or somebody leak one of these patent papers and the next big idea. That must be pretty cool. I mean, do you have some secrets probably up there, don't you?
Yeah, we certainly try to keep, you know, some of the things that we think are advantageous to our business. You know, we don't try to reveal that until it's ready. But it is a lot of what you just said, though. It's a lot of looking at, you know, some of the investments other companies are making on massive scale. Artificial intelligence, you know, which is probably what you're alluding to. Certainly, we're not the inventors of, you know, the core research of artificial intelligence. But if you think about what we can do with that in our business, an example was we just acquired a company called Avigilon, and they're essentially a turnkey video surveillance company. But the magic and secret sauce is they use artificial intelligence in the camera on the edge to look for things of interest. So we have kind of a saying that, you know, nobody watches the video because we're producing so much video now, nobody can. So it's only realistically usable after the fact. But if technology is creating this, proliferation of cameras, technology maybe can help solve the problem. So we use AI in this case to watch the video looking for perhaps a security perimeter breach, you know, an unexpected pattern or motion that's actually occurring. Use that to highlight that to a user so that they don't have to watch the video. Technology is watching and alerting them. So applying some of these cool things that we talk about in those sorts of ways for our users is kind of the way we look at it.
And hearing you talk, I almost think, is there going to be a day when there's not actually a user and it's all robots and artificial intelligence that are handling the equipment?
Yeah, well, I think those days are a long way off. Yeah. And the way we look at that, I get that question often, by the way. And so certainly people, when they hear AI, they think of the Terminator and, you know, the thing that's actually displacing people. But the way we look at it is it has a tremendous ability to augment the human condition, the human being, as we are generating more and more data. So I saw a statistic the other day that I think we generated 20 zettabytes of data last year. Now, zettabytes, 10 to the 21st bytes, or one with 21 zeros. And that's really hard to get your head around, other than it's big. So I did see an estimate of the number of grains of sand on the planet Earth. So Steve, picture every beach, every desert, every place where there's sand. And imagine you could add all that up. A zettabyte is 100 times more than that.
Wow.
And so we're producing that at an ever-increasing rate. So we're using technology to actually harness and use that data for meaningful outcomes in real time.
I go back to the anniversary again. How can people help you celebrate? Is there going to be a cake? Is there going to be some sort of party that people can come to? You mentioned the museum. Is that something that's open to the public? Or
Yeah, no, it's not generally open to the public, but definitely you'll start to see some indicators around the city. So we'll cover one of the brown line, I think it is. So you'll start to see that. Definitely, wear your Motorola hat, wear your Motorola banner, go buy a radio. Those are all great things to do. And for sure.
And then all of the success has come with you being in the Chicago area. We've talked about Israel. We've talked about Silicon Valley, these other places. But Motorola's always been here, Motorola Solutions, Motorola Mobility. Why Chicago? How has that helped you be successful?
Yeah, great question. So to your point, Motorola was founded in 1928, and it was in the city of Chicago. At one point in time, moved its headquarters to Franklin Park and then further west to Schaumburg, but always in the Chicagoland area. And today we have about 3,100 employees in the Chicagoland area, those 16,000. Then a couple of years ago, we moved headquarters back downtown, to just West Loop area. And, this has just always been the place where Motorola grew up. It's been good to Motorola, the people that we were able to access and bring in. And then, like you said earlier, we have to think about the world. But this has been HQ, and it's obviously served us well.
Paul, it's wonderful meeting you, and please give all of our best to everybody at Motorola Solutions.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate the time.
Paul Steinberg is Senior Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for Motorola Solutions. You can find them online at MotorolaSolutions.com. Again, their 90th anniversary this week, tomorrow, actually. So we'll continue our conversation with Paul after the bell, and we'll post more of our conversation in our podcast of the opening bell a little bit later at WGNRadio.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is the opening bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of the opening bell. You know, we generate a lot of data with everything we do, whether it's taking steps, going to a movie, things we buy at the store, conversations we have. But how do we put that in, let's say, a story for our business or maybe for our education? We're happy to have with us today the author of Data Visualization Made Simple, Insights into Becoming Visual, the author, Kristen Sosulski, is an associate professor of information systems and the director of the Learning Science Lab at New York University's Stern School of Business. Kristen, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, Steve. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about data visualization first. For folks who may not be aware of it, I'm sure they've seen it, whether it be in a newspaper or on a website. Explain what it is.
Data visualization is really a process. It's a way of using data to create data graphics. It's a visual way to tell a story with data.
Why is it important that we do this the right way? I know this is the point of your book. It has to be done in a certain way, doesn't it?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, there's various use cases for visualizing data. One is really to transform data into information. So no amount of staring at a spreadsheet is really going to teach you about the data, right? So visualization is a powerful way to make sense of the data that might be massive or messy. Second use case is to communicate. So when we can take data attributes like our variables and simplify them into a visual language, we can see patterns and trends as they reveal themselves. And third, we can use data graphics to show findings, insights, and results, and present this as evidence to our audience. So we see this in the paper every single day.
How essential is this to, let's say, a business, a small business, a large business, to be able to take the data that comes in and put it in a format like this that's easy for people to understand?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, visualization is a way to make access to data equitable, right? So you're not looking at a spreadsheet of raw data. You can use things like dashboard displays or web-based interfaces to change an organization's culture regarding data use. Access to shared information in a way that's easy to understand can promote data-driven decision-making throughout an org.
Your book is almost like a textbook, step-by-step instructions. That's kind of why you've done it, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I have a passion for really bringing the practice of visualization to the forefront. So I provide in-depth examples and use cases by real professionals who show you how they use it in their practice.
And I bet you've been able to see who does it well and who doesn't. Seeing examples of both are probably important. Give us an example of how it is done well and how it's not done well.
Well, I mean, data graphics are only as good as the insight it can provide. So if there's no insight, no finding, no call to action, there's no reason to create a data graphic.
Is this something hard to learn if somebody is just starting out in this area? What is the learning curve here?
It just takes diligence and practice. And I say it's adding the extra 20%. So if you're already doing an analysis, put the extra 20% in to make that analysis or those results and findings stand out by creating an easy-to-read graphic that shows the key insight that anybody can see at a glance.
Data comes from all kinds of places that I mentioned in the open. We have Fitbits on that's gathering data. Our cell phones are probably gathering data. All of these places. Where are the normal sources for this, and where do you find sources for data to make these graphics?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, they're probably lying right inside your company. You probably already have most of the data that you need, and now it's about asking those right questions in order to reveal those insights. You probably have it already.
Teach this at school at NYU. Give us a sense of who the students are that you're teaching.
So I equip executives and MBAs in the visualization of data. And managers really need to lead through effective presentation and communication. And if you think about it, visualization is a way that you can simplify the way that you communicate a complex analysis to stakeholders. And so this is my audience.
What would be the takeaway from the book that you want people to learn?
Really, it's whether you're predicting customer conversion, identifying new markets, or improving a process, a well-designed data graphic can reveal and translate this important information. If you can understand it, you can make a decision and take action.
Is it for wonks, or is it for people that can understand this thing? I know, as I'm asking you questions this morning, people are probably saying, well, wait a second, I think you lost me there or lost me there. Give us a sense of the importance of being able to be on a level that everybody understands.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, the idea is that you know your data the best, and your audience probably doesn't. So how do you create that common ground? And that's really putting yourself in the shoes of the audience. And if you can walk someone through an analysis or persuade them on your message, showing them evidence that leads them through a presentation is really powerful. It's really for anyone to embark on adding visualization to their practice.
Kristen, thank you for being with us this morning. All the best with your book. Best of luck with it going forward.
Thank you so much. Really happy to be here.
Kristen Sosulski, who is an assistant associate professor of information systems and the director of Learning Science Lab at New York University Stern School of Business. The book, again, is called Data Visualizations Made Simple, Insights into Becoming Visual.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, stocks look like they'll have a week open a little bit later on this morning when Wall Street opens up for business for the day at 8:30. Dow futures down about 40 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are lower as well. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We're still adding up the death toll of livestock and poultry in North Carolina. The count now, according to the North Carolina Department of Agriculture, 3.4 million chickens confirmed killed in the floods and about 5,500 hogs killed in the floods as well. But we're still counting, and that's going to take quite a while because some of the floodwaters have not receded enough so that farmers could in to check the hog barns. But today, Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue will get a first-hand look at the flood damage in North Carolina. He'll be spending the day touring farms that were impacted by the storm. Meanwhile, in the marketplace, livestock traders will be taking a look and reacting to the cattle on feed report last Friday. Showed that 11,125,000 cattle were in feedlots as of September 1, 6% more than a year ago, and more than analysts had expected. The placement of cattle in the feed yards during August totaled 2,070,000 head, 7% more than a year ago, and again above analyst predictions. And several analysts are saying the cattle trade could be 50 cents to a dollar lower today based on the report. But we'll keep an eye on trader reaction to that. And the grain market, well, harvest moving along. So we'll get the reports this afternoon on how much progress. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, outlook for Monday, September 24th, Chicago Fed National Activity Index out. The Dallas Fed Manufacturing Survey also due. The U.S. has imposed tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. Mac OS Mojave launches today. Looking ahead to the rest of the week, KB Home and Nike earnings tomorrow. We'll get a report on U.S. consumer confidence on Wednesday. Bed Bath & Beyond, CarMax, and the Federal Reserve interest rate decision is due. We'll also get a report on new U.S. home sales for the month of August. Rite Aid on Thursday, earnings, Carnival, Accenture, also revision of U.S. second quarter GDP, and then on Friday, it is the end of the third quarter. Just some of the things that could move the markets.